The Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning, and welcome to the first episode of A View From Afar for 2022. And today, as always, we are joined by political scientist Paul Buchanan. And Paul and I, we will discuss what to expect in 2022 with regard to global foreign affairs. And specifically, we will analyse what's behind this Europe, USA, NATO, Ukraine, Russian Federation diplomatic battle. We'll also consider how are authoritarian states reacting to the USA's re-emergence as an apparent superpower? And on the back of that, we will examine what does the intensity of US-led military air, land and sea exercises, what does that signal? But before we deep dive into these issues, remember, if you are joining us live via the social media platforms, feel free to comment as we can include those comments and that interaction in this program. Okay, so let's cross to Paul Buchanan, who's waiting online to dig down into these issues. Good morning, Paul.
Good afternoon, and happy New Year to you.
Yeah, tanakwea, eho, and ka pai to that. I'm looking forward to getting into this, the first episode for 2022. This is our third season that we're doing, isn't it, Paul?
Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but time flies when you're having fun and all that, so let's keep it going.
Let's keep it going. Yeah. So, what we put in the thing there, series 03, episode 01. So that's something that we're looking forward to doing on a weekly basis on New Zealand time around midday three on the Thursdays, which equates to in the United States when we're on this daylight time zone anyway, to Wednesday evening around six. I think it is, isn't it, Paul?
It is indeed.
So let's get into this, Paul. Let's start off with the European situation and all of the complex juxtapositioning that is going on. Just in the beginning of this year, we saw Boris Johnson in the United Kingdom under intense pressure for all sorts of things, but largely what they're calling Partygate, of course. We saw Emmanuel Macron from France needing to assert himself politically. He's got elections on his mind as well at some stage there. We've seen, obviously, the NATO leadership and the United States President Joe Biden entering into a very powerful and persuasive diplomatic stoush with the Russian Federation's Vladimir Putin. And squashed in the middle, we have got the Ukrainian people. Paul, with that backdrop, what do you make of all of what has been going on, where it's shaping, and what kind of trajectory do you believe it is embarking on right now?
Let me do this. Let me just briefly mention something about the backdrop politics to what's going on in the Ukraine, and then get into that. So,
yeah.
A while ago, I was asked if I had any predictions for 2022 when it came to international relations. And basically what I think we're going to see is an intensification of the competition about the future of the international order, the near future to medium future. On the one hand, you've got the Western liberal internationalists who have created what they say is a rules-based order to mollify conflicts and that sort of thing. And more recently, we have a group of authoritarian states, middle-sized and large, led by Russia and China, who are challenging that liberal order and believe that it's time to shift to something different. And they're not without justification, because the liberal international order is a post-colonial creation of the West, for and by the West. And although some third world countries have bought into it, things like the World Bank, the IMF, all these sort of institutions were created in the image of the West. But that was at a time when Russia was the Soviet Union, was excluded, and China was a non-entity. Now, the Russians and Chinese are asserting their great power status. They are backed by countries like Turkey, backed by countries like now Brazil under Bolsonaro, who don't see much merit in the international order. And they believe that this is their moment of opportunity to press the case that perhaps we should go back to a more, if not anarchic, a more realist-based order, where you use your national power unencumbered by these multinational rules and whatnot, knowing that those rules favor Western liberal democracies over everybody else. The challenge is now, and this gets to your point when you talk about Boris Johnson and Macron, obviously Trump to Biden, the Russians and the Chinese see this as a window of opportunity. Well, all authoritarians do, because liberal democracy is in crisis. The crisis is one of leadership. I mean, again, Boris Johnson pretty much epitomizes the vanity, the sclerosis of liberal democracies. Donald Trump was another version. And so I believe what we're going to see this year is that this new emerging power alliance of authoritarians are going to press what they see as their advantage, and they are going to push against the rules. They are going to violate the norms in order to assert their national interests. And that's what we're seeing with the Russians in the Ukraine. And they have
Do they do that within the multilateral bodies, which becomes quite obvious to the world's populations? Or do they do it in different ways?
Well, they have a multi-pronged strategy. I mean, you know, both the Russians and the Chinese are nothing but if not sophisticated. On the one hand, they engage in the hybrid warfare techniques of disinformation and whatnot inside places like the United States, meddle in their elections, but that's to weaken them from within, and they've been very successful. We have to admit that. On the other hand, they engage in diplomatic offensives where they actually use multinational institutions against themselves. So they take the rules as given, and they sort of turn them on the head. Best case in point is the UN Security Council. You can't get anything through that thing over the objections, the vetoes of China and Russia.
Well, let's just look at that, you know, within the Security Council, the United Nations apparatus, you know, and let's look at that interrelationship between the Russian Federation and the People's Republic of China. If we go back to 2014, as I understand it, when Russia invaded into the Crimea areas and that lower southern parts of Ukraine, when it came to a vote at the Security Council, China abstained. Do you think that things have changed, that this window of opportunity will solidify and cement these two powers together in those big multilateral bodies and significantly amongst Security Council and basically render them impotent?
Yes, I do, in the short answer. I mean, let's think about it. The Chinese have territorial ambitions of their own, not just, you know, to control the sea lanes of communication traveling through the East and South China Seas, but they have territorial ambitions vis-a-vis neighboring states, except for Russia. And so, you know, we've seen them annex part of the territory of the Kingdom of Bhutan. Of course, Nepal is always under siege in one way or another, and they're constantly clashing with the Indians over their disputed territory in the Himalayas. So it's a marriage of convenience between the Russians and the Chinese to support each other in various security forums around the world, of which the UNSC is the foremost of them. But the bigger picture is that they're pressing an advantage to establish themselves on different terms with the West. And so let's turn to the Ukraine, because it's such a good case to study. Yeah. The objective of now, the backdrop to this is that Russian geopolitical theory has always been about creating a buffer around Mother Russia. They have the longest land borders of any country in the world. I wouldn't think they'd feel insecure when it comes to the various stands, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, but they do. They're worried about ethnic unrest. They're worried about irredentism, all those sort of things. And then when it gets to Eastern Europe, let's face it, a lot of those countries used to be part of the Soviet Union. They were conquered by war. They were taken after World War II. And the Russians want them back, to be honest with you. Now, they can't get them back by military control, but what they can do is neutralize them and create a buffer around Russia that keeps NATO out. And so what I would call this is the Finlandization of Eastern Europe. You may remember that Finland...
I've just pulled up the Kiwi Politico piece that you wrote on this, and where you mentioned this as well. And I encourage people to dive down deep into this, Paul, if they're interested from what we're talking about here.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much for that. Much appreciated. Yeah. So during the Cold War, the Soviets basically said to Finland, you must remain neutral. You cannot join NATO because we'll invade you. If you want to have some degree of autonomy in your sovereign state of affairs, you just stay out of it, stay out of everything. And the Finnish complied. They were neutral throughout the Cold War. They want to do the same thing, not just with Ukraine. This isn't just about the Ukraine. In fact, I'd say Ukraine is just the pawn. They want to neutralize or Finlandize Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. They already have Belarus on their side.
And hence so the military hardware that is in Belarus. There's some sort of codependencies in a sense between Belarus's Lukashenko and Russia in a sense. It makes sense when you look at a map of this, doesn't it? Is Poland a different kettle of fish?
Yeah, Poland is. But I see the thing about Soviet troops in Belarus is they can be used two ways. They can be used against Belarusian resistance or opposition as much as they can be used to invade the Ukraine. Now, Putin doesn't really have an intention to fight a war, but certainly not one that would gain control over Ukraine. He doesn't have enough troops. 150,000 troops will not take the totality of the Ukraine. He'll be faced with a prolonged guerrilla resistance from a very well-armed Ukrainian army, and they have assets. Even if he goes into the Ukraine, it'll be a limited incursion to gain control over the Russian-speaking areas of eastern Ukraine, particularly the Donbass region. That that would de facto annex Ukraine the way Georgia was annexed. The Russians now control 40% of Georgian territory. So that, I think, might be his end game if he uses the military, but he really doesn't want to. And there's go ahead. You go ahead.
What concerns me there is I can think back in history that there are kind of parallels. If you remember back into around 1939, and Germany, under Nazi Germany, of course, Adolf Hitler and his troops used the same reasonings to actually enter into Czechoslovakia and the German side, the German-speaking parts of that, and certainly their interest in Austria, but Czechoslovakia in the first sense. And then, of course, we know our history from there. Do you see parallels to that? From the point of view of seeing boundaries that do not supposedly reflect the cultures, the language, and perhaps even the sentiments of those that are living within those enclaves.
Well, I think your historical parallel is excellent, but particularly because it's relevant to what I was just about to say. There is a saying attributed to Churchill when looking at Hitler, that goes this way. He may not want war, but he wants is the spoils of war. And he was referring to Czechoslovakia. The issue is this. If Russia can get what it wants, the Finlandization of Eastern Europe without firing a shot, that's the best preferable outcome. And the Russians have said, including in Syria, that Russian-speaking or ethnic Russians in places like the Ukraine, but also there are Russian-speaking populations in all of these Eastern European countries. They are, by bloodline, Russians, and Mother Russia will come to protect them. I mentioned Syria because there's 100,000 Syrian-Russian dual nationals in Syria, which is a major part of why the Russians got involved and turned the tide of war in Syria. Now, to be objective, and again, I'm backing this against them pushing for a more realist system of international relations. Forget the norms and rules and the group hugs and the namby-pamby, this, that, and the other. Might makes right. Power is the lever on which, you know, you exercise your national fortunes. Think about this. You mentioned that the Russians are in Belarus, and I can imagine that many of our American friends will go, ooh, boo, hiss, you know, bad, they're intervening. Well, the Americans just put 3,000 troops into Romania, supposedly to help evacuate Americans who want to leave the Ukraine. The Americans have what, 150 bases around the world? They got troops all over the place.
But they've got significant investments with hardware, soldier presence, and also infrastructure in Romania, haven't they? Going right back to when the United States was pulling supposed terrorists out of Afghanistan, and Romania was one of the bases of which they were transiting and also processing, if you want to put it that way.
Transiting. There was
transiting and processing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So these are the ones where there was exclusion certificates signed and agreements made with those states that excluded the United States personnel from being taken to the International Criminal Court.
Well, and so it's very good that you mentioned this. Okay, now so the U.S. operates black sites in Romania during the war on terror. Well, what does this tell us? What's good for the goose is good for the gander. We cannot complain about the Russians using their muscle to improve their geopolitical system position in Eastern Europe if countries like the United States are going to throw their weight around all over the world. That's the Russians' point. The Russians' point, the Chinese point, is you're hypocrites. You guys intervene all over the place, and supposedly that's for the good of the global community. We intervene in places close to us, and it's an outrage. But more importantly, in terms of the outcome, Putin's looking across various tables. He's looking at NATO. He's looking at the EU. He's looking at the U.S. And all he can see is a compendium of weakness. A lot of people talking, but no one's going to walk the walk. Do you think NATO is going to defend the Ukraine? If he does make a move, do you think the United States will? They won't. They'll sit on the sidelines, gathering.
Yeah. So it seems in some ways, both sides, if we look at it in a bipolar kind of way, that the Russians don't want war. They can't hold Ukraine, as you've detailed here, for those reasons. And the West doesn't want it either. But it seems like what the bottom line is here is that buffer zone, getting down to that, looking at the maps once again and seeing that Russia feels very uneasy when that becomes a very thin Western line on its Western border. So if we look at that, do you think that the two sides, if they are in a diplomatic bluffing configuration, are going to emerge out of this in the next few weeks or even months with some sort of understanding that Ukraine perhaps will not enter into NATO agreements, as the Russians expect, and the United States may use its opportunity to go into arms talks or nuclear reduction type talks once again, restart the SALT talks, for example? Do you think that those are some of the things we can expect in 2022 to come out of this as opposed to war?
I think that the status quo will be modified. We have to remember, too, that the Russian campaign is not exclusively in the Ukraine. There's been numerous power outages and hacking incidents in places like Estonia and Latvia. You know, they're really working the sort of hybrid warfare aspects without pointing a gun in the Estonian or Latvians' direction. So they're doing a full court press. They're interestingly, Selim, Hawks and the U.S. military and some other Western militaries are trying to bait the Russians into going into Ukraine now. What they're arguing is that you can't wait till spring because you'll get bogged down in the swamps and marshes that permeate most of the eastern and northern Ukraine. An invasion from Belarus from the north would see them in 2 foot deep mud during the spring. So their idea is try to goad the Russians to move during winter, and then they'll get stuck there in spring because they won't be able to overrun the Ukraine in 2 months. As it turns out, the Russians are very good swamp and marsh fighters.
But I was also going to say that if anything shows us in history from Napoleonic invasions to Adolf Hitler invasions with Operation Barbarossa, that the Russians know their weather.
They do know their weather. And so it's folly from these hardliner hawks in places like the United States to try to get the Russians to move, because they think then they'll get bogged down and we can slap them around. That's not going to happen. The more likely scenario is the Russians are going to get most of what they want. There will be an agreement that NATO will not expand any further. You see, in retrospect, NATO expansion in the early 90s, I was there in the Pentagon when that first started, and I remember a wise old Marine general turned to me in the course of another conversation and said, "We're going to regret this because we see it as a peace offering to the Russians. Come on and join the community of liberal democracies in a security pact based on not collective security, but cooperative security." What the Russians saw was a threat. They're like, "You're going to expand right up to our borders, such as in Poland, which is a NATO member now. We will not have that." And the one thing the Russians have been consistent about is they will not live with that status. They've been saying that for 30 years. They just weren't listened to. They were ignored throughout the 90s. So, you know, the Russians are going to come in and go, we will not live with a status quo that allows for NATO expansion into the Ukraine. That will start a war. But even its smaller neighboring countries, we'll accept neutrality because it puts some physical distance between your troops and our troops. And we've shown that we can live with that. But if you try to press the advantage and move into these countries in any further way, militarily wise, there's going to be issues. And this particular issue of the Ukraine will be resolved in our favor, not yours. So I think at the end of this, which will extend into the summer, I mean, remember, even if the Russians were worried about getting bogged down in the swamps of the Ukraine, there's always summertime. So, you know, I mean, they can wait. You know, it's ridiculous to think that they're worried about the weather. But what they do want to do is push a reconfiguration of the European strategic balance in their favor. And my reckoning in 2022 is they're going to gain that advantage. They're going to gain that readjustment, if you will, as part of the larger readjustment of the international system that they and the Chinese are pushing so hard for.
Okay, if we take that, we've discussed the authoritarian. I resist using the word axis because I don't believe that that's an accurate one at the moment. But that configuration of authoritarianism. Now let's look at the United States. That there's every appearance under Joe Biden that he has been reclaiming by degrees the United States' reputational investments of, if you want to put it that way, toward super re-emerging as a superpower status. And the way it's behaving under Joe Biden administration is as if it already has the superpower status in the bag, that it's got itself back as the global significant power of which can control not just the discourse but the history and the outcomes at any given point. That's the appearance of it, Paul. Can you dig down deeper and tell us what you believe the reality of all this is and what the need is that would be taking shape in these diplomatic dialogues that we are witnessing at the moment?
Well, I'll tell you from the onset that I don't think the United States will ever return to the status of the sole superpower in the world. I mean, it's as if the U.S. wanted to go back to a rectangular table, but the table is now round. You know, there's other players that aren't going away. So the idea, and Biden has said this, that he's going to take a seat at the head of the table, he's deluded. That's never going to happen. He can sit around the table with the other players. He may have a centerpiece seat. But those days of being the sole superpower, those are over.
Now, you think he's the chairman of the board, in a sense, of other nations?
Yeah, and you know, remember, chairmen of the board are in their positions by the grace of the other board members. So, you know, there has to be consent, consensus, and tacit alliances behind that position of preeminence. And that brings me to the idea that what we're seeing is the United States is trying to reassert and improve upon its major security alliances. See, it knows after all of the wars of the last 20 to 30 years that it cannot go it alone. It hasn't even prevailed in regional wars in which it did have allies. You know, it lost in Afghanistan. It lost in Iraq. It's in a stalemate. And I mean, I hate to say this to my American friends, but a lot of those U.S. lives died in vain. And so Biden, I think, knows that. He knows that they need to lead coalitions of military allies who share roughly the same principles and norms, i.e. liberal democracies, emerging democracies, even places like Singapore, which if authoritarian are pro-Western. I mean, the Singaporean are in their majority ethnic Han Chinese, but they don't like the Chinese system of rule. So he's trying to coalesce, mainly in Asia now, but certainly with regard to NATO, those security alliances after all the damage that Trump did to them. And then there's the issue of whether the United States can fight. The United States military has been exhausted by the endless wars of the last two decades, but it does have a reservoir of power, and that reservoir is in the Navy and the Air Force. It's the ground troops who are exhausted. You know, they simply cannot rotate in and out the way they used to. But if the theater of operations is the maritime and airspace, then the United States still has strategic advantages in most parts of the world. And so I think what we're seeing with the uptick in exercises and that sort of thing recently,
yeah.
In fact, there's right now, I think, three ongoing exercises in East Asia involving everybody from Vietnam to the Philippines. Of course, the Australians, now they're the sheriff's deputy in the Southern Hemisphere. So the U.S. is basically saying in that instance to China, you may want to change the strategic balance in this region, but it's going to be a lot tougher than you think, and it's going to cost you a lot more, both in diplomatic prestige as well as, you know, a simple economy to sustain your momentum outside of your inner territorial seas. See, the Chinese are trying to break out into the blue Pacific. They're trying to expand westward territorially. And what the United States and others are saying, we're going to make it very costly for you to do so. And by the way, it's going to be enormously costly for you to try to claim Taiwan the way you did Hong Kong. Completely different kettle of fish. I would argue this. It's in the U.S. interest to do so. Obviously, a lot of these medium and smaller countries have chosen to ally themselves with the U.S. New Zealand clearly has. In spite of our independent policy. But I'm not entirely sure that it's sustainable over the long term, because what the authoritarians looking at the United States have in their favor is the polarization and disunity within the United States. I mean, come 2024, it's a distinct possibility that Trump may be back in office. Right now in 2022, it's more than a distinct possibility that the Republicans are going to gain control of Congress. And then who knows what's going to happen there, because the Republican Party has gone into crazy land. If you're an adversary of the United States, and you're looking at this, I mean, I try to put myself in the shoes of a big player policymaker. Look over there. I would say, if I was Chinese, let's not do anything provocative and just wait for the November elections. See what happens after that. Because if the Republicans win, then Biden is more than a lame duck. He's a dead duck. And then it's a matter of which Republican is going to outmaneuver Trump. And you might start thinking, well, I got to be talking nice to Trump because our longer term future is secured by courting him, not Joe Biden and the Democrats. So the longer play, which both Russia and the Chinese do very well, is now fully in play because of the weaknesses of the U.S. political system that have now seeped into the social fabric. I mean, the United States is a very, I would call it, frayed country. Frayed on all dimensions. To its credit, it's economically rebounding, and that economic rebound is being felt. And it will be felt. It will literally trickle up into the military in terms of new weapons programs and the like. But the question is the United States increasingly a paper tiger who looks good on paper, but may not have the will to fight after all that it's been through, both internally as well externally, over the last 20 some odd years?
Okay, so if we take all of that, and just as we're concluding this episode, if we look at NATO, is NATO basically almost dead in the water, or is it heading that way? And the second part of the question is, if you were in Poland's shoes, Latvia's shoes, Lithuania's shoes, Ukraine's shoes, do you think that they would look at a more independent existence as an alternative to the protection of the NATO umbrella, and perhaps even look at the Scandinavians and how they have used neutrality? And you mentioned Finland in your Kiwi Politico piece and touched on it in the dialogue just before, Paul. So with those two things there, how do you see 2022 shaping up potentially in the people's interests in those Baltic states and Ukraine?
Well, it's a really interesting question, because there's actually two different answers. For NATO, this has been a godsend. Remember, NATO was created to counter the Soviet Union. They lost their way after the end of the Cold War, and they got into humanitarian missions, they got into peacekeeping, they got into a lot of things, including Afghanistan, that had nothing to do with Europe. And the Russians just bid their time. Now the bear is back. And so security conservatives throughout Europe are quietly, you know, tipping their glasses to Putin, because it gives them a reason to exist. So NATO, the core NATO countries, which now include Poland, the Polish are the most hawkish of the NATO countries when it comes to Putin. They don't like him, and they're willing to fight him. I think he knows that taking on the Poles is very different than dealing to the Ukrainians. And so for NATO, this is a reaffirmation of what they were supposed to be about from the get-go. And so I think they're welcoming this stuff, particularly if it doesn't cost them a life. If it turns out it turns into a diplomatic solution, which pushes the neutrality of the small buffer states separating core, what used to be known as Western Europe, from Russia, I think a lot of the countries will accept that new status quo. Now, NATO may be happy. The Poles, as one of the newer members, may be happy. But you mentioned those smaller Baltic states. They're not going to be happy. Countries like Estonia have gone deeply democratic. I would argue Estonia is more democratic than the United States at this point. they don't want to be Finlandized. They don't want to be de facto part of Russia. They may agree not to be part of NATO, and I forget who is or who isn't at this point. But be they Latvians, Lithuanians, Estonians, they're not going to be happy with a status quo that precludes the possibility of their ever joining or relying on the West in the case of Russian encroachment on their national territory. Now, the Russians like to play the hybrid warfare game, but Georgia and the Ukraine show us that if push comes to shove, they will use physical force to impose their will on a usurper or a challenger. And so the smaller states have reason to be concerned. Let's also remember, and New Zealand's a classic example of this, small countries prefer the rules-based order, however biased it may be, over anarchy. Might make right is not good for small countries. And so we shy away from a realist conceptualization of the international order because we want self-binding rules, mutually binding rules on everybody, big and small. The Latvians, the Lithuanians, the Estonians are in the same boat as New Zealand on that score. So I think while NATO, if not rejoice, will be happy about the reemergence of the Russian threat on its eastern frontier, the countries closest bordering on Russia, who are not already aligned with Russia, have very real reason to fear.
Mm. On that point, Paul, thank you for the first episode of 2022. We'll be bringing A View From Afar back to you all again next week around Thursday midday, New Zealand time, which is Wednesday evening in the United States Eastern side. And until that time, thank you very much for your attendance. And also do feel free to keep the dialogue going on the social media platforms or the commentary and other platforms that this program is broadcast and on demand on. Until then, thank you again, and we'll see you soon. Take care.